If some people came to you and said, "We wish to see Jesus the way the Greeks do in today's gospel," what would you do? Where would you point them? Would you bring them to church? Would you hand them a Bible? Would you take them to a hospital or a prison or a school? Maybe you could ask them what they're looking for. In our context, a person is probably not going to use the same words. John's story, after all, is rooted in first century Jerusalem during the festival of Passover, with an excitable crowd swarming to see Lazarus while waving palms at the man who healed him. So those Greeks want to know what all the commotion is about, I imagine. But they're also looking for answers or meaning or a way back home. Isn't that what we're looking for too, with headlines of hate in the news this week and violence against women and people of color again? What do the folks you encounter want to see? More time for themselves and their families? Rest? Purpose? Justice? An end to division? The healing of relationships? Meaningful work? A living wage? Thriving neighborhoods? Less crime? No violence? Better schools? And what do you show them? How about God alive and on the loose? How about love more powerful than any death-dealing hate? How about Jesus on the margins, in the barrio, at the courthouse, on the street, at the grocery, and in your business? At the risk of making you very nervous, I suggest that you invite the seekers who want to see Jesus to look at your life. Now, I can hear you mumbling, "I'm not Jesus," but look. If you're trying to follow him as best as you know how, that's good enough. And that's how it works. Ask to walk alongside the person. Share your struggles and triumphs. Teach each other how to make meaning. Shift your perspective. Ask them what hurts. Listen. Intend their well-being. Act on that intention. Show them what faithfulness looks like. Listen more. Now that I have everyone squirming, I'll tell you that I'm not always ready for this assignment either. As a husband and a dad and a teacher, I want my life's actions to be congruent with my beliefs and hopes. I want to practice what I preach. But at any given moment, none of us measure up to the standard that we've set for ourselves. But instead of getting stuck in the ways that we fall short of the mark, why not rise to the occasion of such scrutiny, like a high school athlete playing lacrosse in front of college scouts? Knowing that someone is looking at us, we can feel like our stumbles are magnified, but we can also raise the level of our game. Once, when I was standing on the sidelines at St. Albans School, I overheard a dad speaking to his son just before such a contest. He put his arm around the boy's shoulders and he said, "All you have to do is be yourself. Be Sam and play like an All-American." That may be all the gospel we need. Remember that someone you encounter today is looking for God and that she might find God in you. If you invited someone to look at your life, what would she see? My friend Anne used to be the rector of Trinity Church in Boston, a significant pile of stone built in the late 19th century with a very prominent speaking platform. Unlike most Episcopal churches, which tuck their pulpits over to one side and place the preacher in dialogue with the communion table, at Trinity in Copley Square, the pulpit is located in the smack dab center of that cavernous room. The sermon clearly has pride of place. Because the Reverend Phillips Brooks, for whom the space was designed, was so talented and famous in his day, the preacher was the focal point, both architecturally and philosophically. So, given his reputation and the possibility of hubris, I was moved to discover that what Brooks had carved into that pulpit, visible only to him, these words, "Sir, we would see Jesus." Phillips Brooks was a rock star in Victorian Boston with all the dangers that pride can bring, but the plea from the Gospel of John that we heard today held his feet to the fire. Brooks knew that the people who crowded around the pulpit didn't come to see the preacher only. They came to see through him the answers to their most vexing questions, the solace for their fears, the hopes for their longings, and the renewing challenge to be their best selves. They came to see Jesus. The Gospel of John begins in this way. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word became flesh and lived among us, and we have seen his glory. But if we relegate the Word becoming flesh only to past history, then we miss the real power of John's incarnational story. What Jesus was, we can be now. A sign of God's presence in the world, hearts to love the unlovable and hands to hold and heal. Our words can bring his word to bear. Our actions can reinvigorate his saving action. When we stop and really listen to our children and to our partners, to our enemies and to those who only frustrate us, we are creating space for God to inhabit and come near. Others can see God in us. George Orwell tells this story, looking back on his time as a soldier in the Spanish Civil War. Early one morning, another man and I had gone out to snipe at the fascists in the trenches outside Huesca. Their line and ours lay 300 yards apart, at which range our aged rifles would not shoot accurately. But by sneaking out to a spot about 100 yards from the fascist trench, you might, if you were lucky, get a shot at someone through a gap in the parapet. Unfortunately, the ground between us was a flat beet field with no cover except a few ditches, and it was necessary to go out while it was still dark and return soon after dawn before the light became too good. We were in a ditch, but behind us were 200 yards of flat ground with hardly enough cover for a rabbit. We were still trying to nerve ourselves to make a dash for it when there was an uproar and a blowing of whistles in the fascist trench. Some of our airplanes were coming over. At this moment, a man presumably carrying a message to an officer jumped out of their trench and ran along the top of the parapet in full view. He was half-dressed and holding up his trousers with both hands as he ran. I refrained from shooting him. Now, it's true that I'm a poor shot and unlikely to hit a running man at 100 yards, and also that I was chiefly thinking of getting back to our trench while the fascists had their attention fixed on the airplanes. But I did not shoot because of that detail about the trousers. I'd come there to shoot at the enemy, but a man who's holding up his trousers, he's not a fascist. He's visibly a fellow creature, similar to yourself, and so you don't feel like shooting at him. I think that scene is a pretty good snapshot of the human condition. In the midst of life's battles, furiously running one errand after another, poised to fight if we have to, holding up our trousers and trying not to let on just how vulnerable we feel. Fleming Rutledge writes, "When God looks at us, he doesn't see titles, bank accounts, club memberships, vacation homes, net worth, or the lack thereof. He sees frail, ornery creatures trying to cover up their spiritual nakedness. And Jesus lived among us at that level. The Son of God gave up all his divine prerogatives and came into the world to be a fellow creature with us in our deepest need. And that's the shocking good news. And here's more. In so many ways, we're God's enemies, deserving judgment. But God looks on us trying to hold up our trousers with two hands and declares that we're not enemies, we're friends. God is every person's friend. And our call is to be no less. Do you hear the grace in the way God sees us? And there's grace in how we can see each other as well. When we look on our own enemies, the folks whom we resent or make us angry, the people we can't quite forgive, or the poor ones we too often forget, when we look on those enemies and see Jesus there, then God has truly become flesh and is living in us. Terry Awell is a Christian who grew up in Israel. Now married to a Jew and living in Michigan, she writes, "When I was 11 years old and living under occupation, I took a chance and after curfew, I ran to visit my grandmother who lived two blocks away from us. On the road, I had to hide under a truck to avoid soldiers who were coming my way. For 20 minutes I lay there in utter fear, watching their boots walk back and forth. My heart was pounding so fast and loud that I was afraid one of the men would hear it. To calm myself, I started begging God to save me from these men and their guns. And then I remembered the words of my mother after soldiers had beaten my father. She asked us to put our fear and anger aside for a moment and to pray for the soldiers, who also must be afraid, she said, in order to act with such hatred. I wondered, are they afraid of little children like me? I wondered, what kind of food do they eat? I wondered, do they have big or small families? And at some point, their voices began to remind me of my neighbors. My fear dissipated a bit as I pictured the soldiers as people I knew. Decades later, I look around and see other devastations created by fear. The collapse of my city, Detroit, when so many middle-class people, mostly white, fled the city. Arab and Muslim communities segregating themselves after 9/11 because of suspicion directed at them. And today again, we allow differences to separate us. When I was hiding under that truck, writes Owl, if my terror had made me lose control and I had started to cry, the jittery soldiers might have pulled the trigger because of their own fears. Thank God I live to wonder about how fear can be deadly. I believe it's fear we should be fighting, not the other, not the enemy. We all belong to the same human tribe, and that kinship supersedes our differences. We're all soldiers patrolling the road, and we're all little children hiding under the truck. If you invited a person to look closely at your life, what would he see? For most of us, depending on the day and the hour, the observer would see both a frightened child and an angry warrior, each struggling to hold up their trousers, lest we be exposed for who we really are. But God knows us with all our warts and bruises, and there's no sense hiding from the one who loves us so. And guess what? That vulnerable one who God sees is exactly the one that the person sitting next to you is longing to see as well. Because, of course, she's a bit lost and wounded, too. On our best days, we're not looking for success or victory or power or privilege. We just want to know that we matter and that our efforts count for something. We want to make a difference and leave the world a little better for our time here. We're looking for integrity and compassion and justice and the radical strength that comes from being open and vulnerable. We wish to see Jesus, and we want to know that love is more powerful than any strife or sorrow or death. It is more powerful than any strife or sorrow or death. What would someone see if he took a long look at your life? Will you be the love that the world so desperately needs? Amen.